You're listening to Truth To You with Jono, and you can download these programs freely from the website at truthtoyou.org. That's truth number two, letteryou.org. And good day to everybody listening around the world. Thank you for your company today. Joining me is Yoel Ben Shlomo. G'day, mate.
Hello.
How you doing? You're exhausted today. You were saying you're a little bit exhausted.
I just said quietly, tired. I'm tired, yes. We had a pretty busy day yesterday. Started at 7 o'clock in the morning, ended somewhere around 12 o'clock at night pretty interesting things in the middle.
Yeah, so you've been
including a strike where we almost had here in Jerusalem, where they were actually threatening not picking up trash. So it was a very interesting morning in general.
I heard about the strike or the possible strikes, but you've been on somewhat of an adventure, right?
Kind of an adventure, yeah. It's something I've never done before. They open this type of thing up every once in a while. I went together. Actually, Nehemiah Gordon dropped me an email last week saying there's this hike to Mount Eval, which is a very, very important mountain, mentioned several times in the book of Deuteronomy and several times in the book of Joshua. So he drops me the email, and I call the people who organize this hike. And first of all, the first thing they tell me is there's no room on the bus. And I'm like, really? That was quick. And they said, yeah, but we're working on another bus. So I get a phone call a couple of days later. We have room. In the end, from so like 50 people, it became a hike of over 100 people.
Oh, wow.
That's pretty massive. And we went up to Mount Eval. And if people don't remember what Mount Eval is, just a bit of geography. Mount Eval is the northern mountain just off of Nablus, also known in Hebrew as Shechem. Nablus, by the way, for all the people arguing, oh, Nablus is a corruption of the name Neapolis, which is a Roman name. Uh-huh. Can't remember exactly which emperor did that, but they changed the name of Shechem, or some people know it as Shechem, to Neapolis or Napolis. And the Arabs, because they don't have a P in their language, there's no P sound, they turn it into Nablus. Ah. So it's called Nablus now. Nablus.
Okay.
Whatever dialect you want to pick. Mm-hmm. And it's north of the city itself. The city actually sits on its slopes. It's actually a very long city in between two mountains. South of it is the traditional Mount Gerizim. That's where the Samaritans are. Samaritans, if people don't remember who they are a group, an ethnic group made out of five nations. Mm-hmm. Which were brought over here when the northern kingdom of Israel was destroyed by the Assyrians. They were brought over. They have a very long history in this area. They used to have a temple up on the mountain. There are still remains of it. Today, they're a very small community. Actually, they were massacred by the Turks, and they're being murdered throughout the centuries. There's only a few hundreds of them left. They're struggling to survive. They have two communities, one on Mount Gerizim and the other one in Cholon, if I remember correctly. Cholon is a city here in Israel. Mm-hmm. There's about 750 of them left. There used to be hundreds of thousands of people. In archaeology, they discovered that they actually spread out in a pretty serious area. Like mostly like, I would say, central northern part of Israel, stretching from the Jordan all the way to the Mediterranean. So they were actually in a very, very big area. And what's very significant of Mount Eval is that Joshua is commanded in the book of Deuteronomy to go and build an altar and write either, it's a bit of a dispute, but either on the altar itself or on rocks that he'll bring from somewhere else, he'll write the entire Mishneh Torah, which can mean the entire Torah or the book of Deuteronomy. Again, different opinions on this one. In 1978, an archaeologist who's a completely secular man continued an ongoing survey. They started a survey in the 1800s and then the early 1900s looking for the site of the altar of Joshua. And they were all looking on the part of Mount Eval. It's a pretty big mountain. I was very surprised how big it is. But again, mountains here in Israel are not like mountains you have in the U.S. where they're like 2,000, 3,000 meters high. Here we have mountains which are mostly just below 1,000 meters, meaning it's just below something like 3,000 feet. But these are the mountains we have here. Mm-hmm. And they were all looking on the side facing Mount Gerizim. No one found anything. There were several surveys that were done. One man, somewhere in the 1920s, found a large rock. And he said, this must be the altar of Joshua. Now, large rock and altar are two very different things.
Sure.
Because we have two words in the Tanakh. One is a mizbeach, derived from the word zevach, which means sacrifice. Zevach, used in the Bible, is supposed to mean, in most cases, a sacrifice, a peace offering, meaning it's been eaten, it gets eaten also by the owner. Mm-hmm. Unlike, for example, the ola, which is a burnt offering, or the asham, which is a sin offering, or chatat, which is also a type of sin offering. But we have the shlamim, which are peace offerings, which are also eaten by the owner. So usually they're mentioned as a zevach. Sometimes they have the concept of zevach mishpacha, which was a family peace offering. Families will bring a sacrifice and do something for some reason. Mm-hmm. On a Rosh Chodesh, we have in the book of Samuel that King David was, Jonathan says that King David went to his zevach mishpacha. It was only an excuse to avoid King Saul, but still we see that it's such a concept. They were looking for it and there was nothing there. Now, a rock can be what's called a bama, a high place, not necessarily an altar. And we see things like this. For example, Yerubal or Gideon, he's told to pour, he makes an offering for the angel. He doesn't know it's an angel yet. Mm-hmm. And in the end, he's told to pour it on a rock. So that would be a bama. That would be like a very small personal altar a person builds for himself. Mm-hmm. But here, we were actually looking for an actual full-fledged altar. So Adam Zelta in 1978 came to this area, came to Mount Nebo. It was still very easy to get there. The Arabs were not as hostile. Nebulus wasn't as big as it was. There's actually pictures from the early 1900s where you see the tomb of Joseph and nothing around it. And what happened was that he came across this terrace, and it's pretty amazing when you arrive there because we went around the mountain. The whole idea was to walk around the mountain, not just going directly to the altar. I actually read he wrote a whole book about this called A Nation Born, Am Nolad. Am is nation, Nolad is born. Mm-hmm. And it's a very difficult book to find. It sold out very, very quickly. And it was just amazing. I walked into a bookstore, I turned my head, and there it is.
Oh, really?
I was looking for it for like 2-3 years. I was looking for a copy. Wow. And I have friends in many, many secondhand bookstores. So when I look for something, they're all looking for it.
Mm.
No one can find. And then one of them found a copy but forgot to tell me. Oh, Hashem, no one touched it. So I bought the copy, and it wasn't too expensive, which is kind of surprising. This book sold out, and I paid almost regular price.
Nice.
Which was also very surprising. Anyhow, so I read through the book. It's an amazing book. Never translated to English, so I'm sorry if anyone's looking for this information about this altar. They can look for it over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
But he comes over this terrace, and it's covered with rock. And they start digging through it, and they're realizing that something was buried here. This wasn't just a pile of rocks. I mean, when you go to the mountain, there's areas where you have terraces, and there used to be large farms, the 25 dunam farm in one place and a 20 dunam farm in another place.
Mm-hmm.
And you see these lines of rocks of the original terrace,
right?
Or markings of the areas where they used to plant things, and he starts digging, and they find pottery.
Mm-hmm.
So they pick out all the rocks, and they're realizing there's some kind of a square structure underneath this pile of rocks. Now, we're talking, if you look at the area itself, first of all, there's a sudden plateau in the mountain itself.
Mm-hmm.
And when you stand there, and I look at it, I kept on saying to Nehemiah, you can put a huge camp here of people, because this is the non-slopy area of the mountain. But the big problem is that it doesn't face Mount Gerizim. This is why they were not looking in that area. So when Adam Zertal was there, he wasn't looking for an altar. He was doing a survey of the land in the area. That's what we were doing in the 1970s, 1980s, when they were able to reach these areas. After 1967, it took a few more years. But from the 70s and 80s, before the first Intifada, they were actually surveying the entire area to get as much information as they can. They didn't know what's going to happen. So you see there's a slope to the west, and then there's a huge open area, and you can put a huge camp there. Now, they're digging, and they find this square structure, and they're digging through, and they find shards and everything, and then they discover there's an actual building here. And when they remove everything, now, not everything was standing. If you Google the picture of the altar, you'll see an entire altar. You see something, if you're looking at a good picture of it, you'll recognize what it looks like. So what they find is a square structure with a ramp to, I would say something like, it looked like more like the west of it, west of the altar, not necessarily mm-hmm. south, which is a big issue because in the rabbinical tradition, the ramp is always to the south. By the way, it's a ramp, not stairs. There's some of the commentators on the Book of Ezekiel take a verse there that says Uma'aloto penot kadim, and they say Uma'aloto means a stair, and there is such a thing that Ma'alot. For example, it says in one place, Ma'alot Achaz. It mentions when they cure King Hezekiah, it says Ma'alot Achaz, the yes. stairs of Achaz. Ma'ala means a stair, but here it's one stair. It's Ma'aloto, not Ma'alotav. The Ma'alotav will become, if you add the diphthong of a yud and then a vav and after the end of Ma'ala, mm-hmm. and then put the tav in, it becomes a construct form. But it doesn't matter. Some people do know Hebrew. Then it becomes plural, and it's not plural. It's single, which tells you it's one stair, which would fit where it says in the book of this after the Ten Commandments, not to go up with a ramp. So you don't want to go up with stairs, just with a ramp, so you don't mm-hmm. expose yourself. You used sure. to wear skirts, not trousers, and not everyone had money for underwear.
Sure.
The priests were combined to wear some kind of underwear. So I actually had an interesting discussion with Nehemiah while we were driving to meet up with the bus. Why, if they're wearing underwear, why does it say that you don't expose yourself? And we're trying to find out why it does that, but we haven't found an answer yet. Mm. So he pulls this thing out. He finds a structure, a ramp, pottery, and what's amazing, and this is what convinced him, this is an Israelite altar. Besides the pottery and everything, they found pottery that fits the period of when they started occupying the land. There were no idols, none whatsoever, not an entire area. They found a scarab which had Ramses II stamp on it, which means we can also give it a date.
Yeah,
or an estimated date.
Mm-hmm.
And when they dug through it, they found something that surprised me, something I have a theory about, but I can't prove it 100% because I don't know all the information that they discovered inside mm-hmm. there. But when they opened up the altar, because they never just go, oh, we got a structure. They'll dig through it a bit. And what they discover is the inside is partially hollow. And inside it, they found, first of all, the hollow part for me is pretty astounding because I personally think that at least part of the time, was earth in it, which corresponds with what we find in the book of Exodus, just after the Ten Commandments. It says that you can make an altar of earth
and stone.
And we find or stone. Mm-hmm. And here, I think because they built an altar of earth, they also filled that area with earth to have both of these commandments.
And that perhaps it eroded away in time with rain and so forth.
It's either that, but I think they might have emptied it out later on because what they discovered, either that or it was empty to begin with. But if it was empty to begin with, it's a bit of a problem because the way Adam Zeltal describes it is that there was a floor. And that's where the fire burnt. Now, Nehemiah and I went into a bit of a discussion about that as well. Nehemiah was leading more towards the area of there was some kind of probably a net on top and fire burning from underneath.
Mm-hmm.
I completely reject that because that understanding comes from a misunderstanding that I think some researchers had about this, that they think that the roof of the altar in the tabernacle, mm-hmm. they think there was a net there. It was more like a barbecue because the altar itself was hollow. It says that you made sides to the to the altar. It says it's Navuv Luchot, which means it's hollow in the center.
Uh-huh.
But I completely reject it for one very simple reason. If the fire is burning inside, there's nothing protecting the wood. So actually what some of the encyclopedias say, and this I think is more sensible, is that the structure itself was hollow, but it was filled in with rocks or earth.
Okay, so can I just ask you a question just to get this straight in my head? My understanding is that any altar has to be made of stone or rocks which have not been fashioned by a tool. Is that correct?
It's correct, and that's exactly what you find there.
Okay.
It was the other amazing thing, that you see that this altar is built according to the specifications of the book of Exodus. You mm-hmm. see, you look at the rocks in the area, and it's very clear they collected rocks from all over the mountain, or at least in the immediate area, and they built the altar from that. These are unhewn rocks. They were not touched by metal. You can mm-hmm. actually see it. It's pretty amazing. And the other amazing thing was the fact that all the animals, they found 960 bones or 941, a large number of bones,
mm-hmm.
and they were all from kosher animals.
Right.
Now, three of the types of bones which were discovered were from animals which we know as a fact can be brought to the altar,
mm-hmm.
goat, sheep, and ox.
Yes.
They found another type of animal, which is a wild animal, which is basically the same animal as Bambi is. Remember, they call it in Hebrew yachmol. I don't remember the exact name in English.
A deer.
But it's basically a type of deer or a gazelle of sorts. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a deer, actually. It's not a gazelle. It's a deer. A gazelle looks a bit different.
Mm-hmm.
And that raised a lot of questions. But if you take the overall information that we have about this altar, you can't argue it's not Joshua's altar. Now, the biggest question which we're faced with is the issue of the location of the altar on the mountain. Now, they were mm-hmm. talking about that a lot. And it does not face Mount Gerizim, at least not the traditional Mount Gerizim. But as far as we know, as far as the understanding goes in the verses, the altar has to face Mount Gerizim. So Adam Zeltal came up with a pretty good solution in this. And I try to expand it even more, but what he said was, what the Samaritans identify as Mount Gerizim is not Mount Gerizim. And everyone raised brows about that. And because of that, his finding was never accepted in the archaeological world as the official altar of Joshua.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is, it's on Mount Gerizim, it fits Torah law, only kosher animals, we're actually able to date it
mm-hmm.
to a time which fits the time of Joshua. And the only real major problem we have is the location of the altar itself. Now, this altar was used only once. It was buried. It's one season use. It was never reused again.
Mm-hmm.
Adam Zeltal points out that maybe there were different stages until they actually erected the altar. So there's a question, did they actually build the altar when they immediately came to the land, when they conquered Jericho and the Ai, and then they went there, or were they preparing the area for that until they arrived there? So they sent a group of people just to prepare the area and build the altar, etc. Or did they arrive there only after 14 years? There's different opinions. The Talmud actually gives an idea that says that they actually built it only 14 years after they entered the land, basically just before Joshua died. Now, we do have in the end of the book of Joshua that there's a temple of God in the area of Shechem, in the area of Nablus.
Mm-hmm.
So that might be it. So it might be that it was there for a short time, but it was still a functioning altar even longer than that. But what's very interesting is there was no actual camp that sat there. This wasn't as if a center of religion for a group of people and they were living around it. Were no bones of donkeys found and no bones of dogs,
mm-hmm.
which would be animals that if this was a domesticated area, these animals, if people were living there for a very long time, these would be animals that would find the area.
Sure.
Because they die and they bury them. The donkeys, for example, are buried.
Mm-hmm.
We don't just leave them out. People bury donkeys in this area.
Sure.
So
now it's very clear. Just to get this straight in my head again, this is now the significance of the location of Mount Gerizim in relation to this altar is most important because of the story that we read. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but they're on one mountain and they're facing each other, proclaiming the blessings. They're on the other side and also repeating the curses. Can you just remind me of that story?
In the book of Deuteronomy, we have a list there of curses.
Mm-hmm.
But it does say that they are to say the blessings and the curses. It says in Deuteronomy 27 that they have to cross it, verse 4, and they shall build an altar. So they should erect stones on a Mount Ebal, and they should cover them with lime or some white paint so they can write on it.
Mm-hmm.
And the first 5 says to build an altar and not to be hewn with metal, and again, that's what you find in the altar.
Mm-hmm.
These are to be whole stones, and that's exactly what you find. Because you look at the rocks there, and they're the exact same rocks you find outside in the open field. And you're supposed to bring a peace offering sacrifices there and rejoice.
Mm-hmm.
And you're to write the on the rocks the Torah. So what it looks like is if there were like 12 rocks or rocks that were the Torah was written on them, but we couldn't find these rocks. One of the stories we have is that these rocks were moved or taken away by someone else. Now, in verse 13, it says that some will stand on Mount Ebal for the curses. And so verse 12 says on Mount Gerizim for the blessings, and then verse 13, Mount Ebal for the curses.
Yes.
Which means they're supposed to be facing one another.
Yes.
Now, one of the arguments I made, but I always found something to disprove it, but one of the arguments I made said, who says the altar has to face Mount Gerizim? So we actually have to look to the book of Joshua. But even if it says that we has to face Mount Gerizim, Adam Zeltal said, who says the Samaritan tradition is the original Mount Gerizim? Maybe there was some other reason they decided to put it there. For example, it's a bigger mountain. Because, for example, the mountain that Adam Zertal recognizes being Mount Gerizim, doesn't have the majesty, the majestic form of Mount Gerizim of today. If you ever look at pictures of it, it's a pretty amazing mountain. And there's no, on the Mount Gerizim that he identifies, is it's a smaller mountain, it's not as impressive, and it's also very far away from the city. Okay. And the Samaritans were sitting in Nablus, in Shechem, which means they might have changed the tradition where Mount Gerizim was just to fit their own personal needs. And we've had things like these in history. For example, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre was a temple to Aphrodite before it was the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And before that, it was a temple to one of the other Roman gods. You know, so changing locations and moving things around for your own personal needs is something which it's not unheard of. We find it all the time in the ancient world.
This is interesting. So let me just read it in English. I've got it in front of me. This is Deuteronomy 27, verse 11 and 12. And Moses commanded the people on the same day, saying, "These shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people when you have crossed over the Jordan, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, Benjamin, and these shall stand on Mount Ebal to curse." And that is Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, and Naphtali. And you're right. Who says they have to be facing each other? I mean, when you visualize it in your head, you just automatically imagine a valley between them and them facing each other and calling out to each other. But who says that has to be the case? That's a very good point. I've never thought of it like that before.
Yeah, that's one of the points I made. But I'm actually now looking for the verses that speak of the actual fulfillment of the commandment, and it's in chapter 8, verse 30, and I'm quickly reading through it.
Chapter 8, verse 30 in Joshua.
Yeah, and I don't see a need here that the altar has to face Mount Gerizim. So even if that's the original Mount Gerizim, it doesn't mean that that's how it was done. Now, by the way, if you look at Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal, the valley between them is pretty narrow, which means if you place the entire nation, or even representatives of the nation, they can still hear each other.
Okay.
But the distance, if they're standing on one side of the mountain here and the other side of the mountain here, there's a valley between them, and the Levites are standing there and the priests and the Levites are standing there with the ark, and they speak. If they're talking in a loud voice, the acoustics there will allow each other, they're allowed to hear each other.
Okay, so you think it would travel anyhow. So let me.
I think it will travel anyhow.
For the listeners, I'll just quickly read this. This is Joshua 8, 30 to the end of the chapter, 35. Now Joshua built an altar to Yehovah, Elohim of Israel, in Mount Ebal. And Moses, the servant of Yehovah, had commanded the children of Israel, as it is written in the book of the Torah of Moses, an altar, the whole stones over which no man has wielded an iron tool. And they offered on it burnt offerings to Yehovah, sanctified peace offerings. And there in the presence of the children of Israel, he wrote on the stones a copy of the Torah of Moses, which he had written. And then all Israel, with the elders and the officers, the judges, stood on either side of the ark before the priests, the Levites, who bore the ark of the covenant of Yehovah, the strangers as well as he who was born among them. Half of them were in front of Mount Gerizim, and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, as Moses, the servant of Yehovah, had commanded before, that they should bless the people of Israel. And afterward, he read all the words of the Torah, the blessings and the cursings, according to all that is written in the book of the Torah. And there was not a word of all that Moses had commanded, which Joshua did not read out before all the assembly of Israel, with the women, the little ones, and the strangers who were living among them. And you're absolutely right. Again, here, you imagine that they're facing each other, but it really is an imagination. There's nothing specific that would concrete that conclusion.
Exactly. So everyone's arguing. I think this is just a rabbit from a hat, just to try to argue this is not Joshua's altar, and there's no history of conquering the land. But this is something classic in the archaeological world. If people have never heard of him, but there's a man called Wendell Jones. He's the original person that the character of Indiana Jones is based on. He unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago, not very long ago. And he pointed out something that I think is a truth. In many of the so-called scientific things that we do, even in medicine, anything we do, physics, whatever it would be, there's still kind of a guessing game. And he says, in archaeology, it's mostly guessing. We find something, and we start guessing what it is. Mm-hmm. Now, unless we find carving on it saying belongs to, and we find an exact name, we know exactly who that person was, we can't really 100% know what it is. Mm-hmm. So archaeology is very, very interesting and very, very good and very important sometimes to learn certain things. I don't think you have to learn everything in archaeology, because if you ever pick up an archaeological book about archaeological survey or something, you'll fall asleep somewhere in the first 10 pages because it's just boring. And I've done that. I've actually sat down to read a book, amazing book, but it was painful to read it because it was so boring. But again, for example, this book I was reading was called Digging the Bible, mm-hmm. and it was written by an archaeologist, a doctor, a PhD in archaeologist, mm-hmm. In archaeology, and he points out a lot of information that shows that the land was conquered by a nation that had no idols and had burnt certain cities, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You find that pattern. Then what happens is they say, but it can't be it, because we decided that if there was an exodus, it was in this and this date, and therefore whatever you say is invalid. But that's how they work all the time. Now, for example, Immanuel Velikovsky, another very interesting person, wrote a book about the chronology, and he claims that the Egyptian chronology is completely off and has a lot of weird things in it. And he compares it to a lot of other things around the world. Now, if he's 100% correct or not, I don't think so. But I think he has a point there where he actually shows, with all due respect to all the archaeologists, and by the way, you should know, everything we know about archaeology today, when it comes to the timeline, is based on theories, insufficient theories of timing of archaeologists from the 1800s and the early 1900s. They put down the basis for everything, and we mush that drum. And the ones the ones who came up and said, no, we have to reassess this, no, we don't want to. We're not going to do that. Why? Because these are the founders. It's like standing there saying, tradition. That's what they're doing. We're used to it being this way, and therefore we're not going to try to rethink it. Mm. And I've seen archaeological discoveries that completely baffle archaeologists, that they're trying to forcefully fit their pre-perceived ideas of what it's supposed to be like into a discovery that they can't understand. But if they recalculate things, it all fits in place. For example, there was called the Homer problem. Homer writes the two stories, the Odyssey, and there's what's the other one? We call it an Alidea, but it has an English. And in the stories, he's describing things that
the Iliad.
Yep. There he describes things that do not fit his time. And the Homer problem creates an issue that there's like a 400-year gap in between the stories and where we position Homer in history. This takes us to a place called Mykenae, which they had certain type of pottery about. In Mykenae, what's very important is Mykenae has information which fits the time that Homer describes, and then stuff that's supposed to fit Homer's time. Mm. Now, when we go into this, when they actually start digging in Mykenae, there's like a black hole there. There's like they start digging through and they discover that there's like a 400-year gap in between two layers. And they explain this, oh, the place was destroyed, but there's no signs of destruction. The place was abandoned, no signs of abandonment. It was just a quick swoop in from what they think was the 12th century BC into the 8th century BC. Look, we solved the problem, which is complete rubbish. That doesn't make sense. It does not make sense. And this was what Manuel Velikovsky was trying to point out. But why does it not make sense? Because they were using Egyptian chronology. They were using what was the classic understanding of everything. We live in a time now where everyone's rethinking everything we know about everything that we've ever learned throughout the centuries. So I think it's about time that the archaeological world will brush off the dust from their brains and take it for clean and start rethinking what they're looking at. Because every time they find something which proves the Bible, oh, we're going to find an excuse why it's not.
Yeah.
For example, there's very few people that I say I despise. This man I despise because he's a liar. Mm-hmm. This man is called Eli Finkelstein. He's from the Tel Aviv University. And the guy systematically tries to disprove everything that proves the Bible. He even wrote a book about it. And he goes all over the news everywhere he can to show, I know that the Bible is not real. Now, he's an accomplished archaeologist, but he's a liar. Because every time he's presented with something which proves the Bible, he'll find some kind of an excuse why it's not. And I've watched videos by him. I've seen things that he's written. And he's always looking at it from the angle of disprove the Bible, where it can easily switch that into proving the Bible.
Mm.
And he's a person I got really fed up with him at one point. and I just stop listening to stuff he says and stop reading his books. Mm. If you ever bought his book, you just wasted your money because he has no proof of what he says. Nothing whatsoever. I've been dealing with this stuff from like the age of 16. I've concluded what I conclude about what these people do. It's basically the entire mindset of the Tel Aviv University. They're very anti-Bible, and against them stand the Jerusalem University, the Hebrew University, mm-hmm. which are not that anti. They're anti. Again, these are people who don't believe in anything that's academics, but they don't believe in the Bible, and they do believe in different things, other things besides the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And at least they're a bit more honest about the information sure. that they're presented with. And so this was an amazing trip. I really enjoyed doing it. It was amazing just to stand in front of this altar and know that this is where the Israelites stood, and this was a functioning altar. And you should know there's only like three.
Just remind everyone. I was just going to say, how many thousands of years? How old is this altar again?
This altar should be 3,300 and something like 3,250, 270 years old.
Okay.
This is one out of three altars which were discovered in Israel. There were very few altars discovered. I would say there were four altars discovered. Joshua's altar, the last remains of the altar in Tel Dan.
Mm-hmm.
Not even the altar itself, that's the sacrificial area was discovered.
Mm-hmm.
There was an altar discovered in Tel Be'er Sheva. I think that altar is actually in the Israel Museum. I've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And the claim was that they discovered the altar of Beth-El. At least that's what I heard, but I've never mm-hmm. seen pictures or read the survey. But that's one of the last things I've heard about altars, that the one in Beth-El was discovered.
Now, I think I remember you telling me that the altar of Joshua is not always available to go and look at. How is it a dangerous place? What made it available for you and Nehemiah to go and see this time?
Okay, so basically what happens is I thought, first of all, big trips like these are very rare. Mm-hmm. They happen every once in a while. Last time I saw a trip like this was like 2 years ago. The issue is you have to go up to a very sensitive area, basically very close to Nablus. There was a group, 12 years ago, there was a small group of people that went up there. One of them was shot dead by terrorists inside Nablus itself. This is why it's very dangerous to go there, very difficult to go there. You have to go with an armored bus and with the military protecting you. Mm-hmm. Now, this time, we actually went with a small military group, which kind of surprised me, but apparently it's not that difficult to do this. But they don't get large groups like they did this time.
Mm-hmm.
I won't be surprised if they advertise this more and more large groups will arrive, but they actually go up to the mountain. People organize to go up to the mountain once a month, just to make sure that the army understands and the Arabs do understand that we want this land, we own this land, and we're going to be there.